history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we'll never know unless we take a little time to ask some questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we go down that road, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every once in a while, we are fortunate enough to meet a centenarian, someone who has reached that age of 100. Not easy to do, and we want to know their secrets. So we'll get to that today with Leonard Francis of Bakersfield, California, where folks listen to Hometown Heroes just about every night of the week on KNZR. I've got to ask you, Mr. Francis, 100 years, and almost all of those here in Kern County, you must like it around here.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
But you were born in Tulare County, north of here, up in a place called Porterville. Your family moved here when you were how old?
1 year.
And a lot of people might say, as a figure of speech, you know, I grew out in a weed patch. But you actually grew up in Weed Patch. There's actually a place on the map called Weed Patch. Where is that?
Oh, that's out southeast of Bakersfield, about 15 miles.
Did you ever hear any snide remarks or comments when you told people you were from Weed Patch?
Always.
Did you come up with any good comebacks for that?
No, I never had one.
Well, what was life like out there in Weed Patch as you're growing up in the 1920s and 30s?
Well, it was great. It was good to grow up on a farm. We didn't have much, but whatever we had, we made ourselves, all our toys. It was just great growing up out there in the farm and have the horses and milk the cows and all everything that goes with farming.
Did you have a big family? Did you have a lot of siblings?
Eight. There was eight in our family. But I was the youngest one, so a couple of the older boys, they were almost married. I was 22 years younger than my oldest brother, so they were just about gone when I come along.
Well, yeah, you were telling me your father was born in 1865, right at the end of the Civil War. That's quite a connection, and now here you are 100 years old. You mentioned the jobs you had to do around the farm and milking the cows and all of that. What was the toughest chore or job or duty you had on the farm?
Picking cotton. Well, I hate to pick cotton, but I'd pick enough to fill my sack a little bit and then sleep on it until my dad find me. Made me start picking again.
Uh-huh. And most people who listening have never had to pick cotton before. Was it the labor part of it? Was it the time of year you have to do it where it's really hot out there? Or what was the worst part of that?
Well, it was just your hands. You picked those bowls and they were sticky on the end. You know, they were sharp when you pulled it out. So you really made your fingers sore. Yeah, that was the worst part about picking cotton. It was just hard labor, you know, just pulling that sack through the rows.
Well, I bet then you found some ways to escape the farm a little bit. Maybe sports was a good way to do that?
It sure was, yeah. We started playing softball out there. And in those days, softball was big because you didn't have TV, you didn't have anything else. So softball become real big in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. Softball was big. So that's what our outlet was, to have fun, you know. Yeah. We started young and just grew up playing ball.
And I want to talk to you more about that, but I realize there's a couple other things I have to ask you about chronologically. And maybe I should ask you this. Did you have a dream or an ambition when you were that kid, 10, 11, 12 years old? Did you have this thought, hey, when I grow up and get off this farm, this is what I'm going to do?
Well, yes, I did. But, you know, we didn't have any money to do anything. So we just kind of let things go. And, we just didn't have the advantage that the kids have nowadays, you know, and to be scouted or anything like that.
Were you thinking you could have been a Major League Baseball player?
Well, I thought so. And quite a few people around here thought so. But I never did.
Well, we'll talk some more about that. But what happened in 1930 out on the farm?
Our house burned down, and we were all out on the farm, and I seen the smoke coming up, and I told my dad, I said, you know, there looks like a smoke coming out of the house. And he looked up, and he says, no, he says, that's on the other side. And pretty quick, the big flames flew up, and I said, no, our house is burning down. And so we all tried to go to the house, and of course, you know, there was no fire departments or nothing like that out there in the country. So by the time we got there, it was gone. It was just practically all burnt down. And it was a great big old two-story house, too. It was big. We had nothing but what we were rearing. But nothing come out of there except my dad come over here, and he had a trunk when he come over to this country. He had a trunk. And the girl across the street, she pulled that trunk out of there. I still have the trunk right to this day. It had a bunch of letters in there and didn't have much anything important except some clothes and letters and stuff. But anyway, I was looking at those letters, and they were from England. They're beautiful. They were from his sister and brothers. And the handwriting's so pretty, I can't read it.
So are you saying that trunk is the only thing that survived the fire?
The only thing come out of that house was that trunk.
Well, I've got to ask you, though. I mean, your whole life has been out on this farm, and in many ways, I'm sure your whole life was in that house. How devastating was that to see that just disappear like that?
Well, being young like that, I didn't realize how bad this was going to affect us. But I look back now, and I can see what it did to my father and mother. It's just awful for them. And I didn't realize it at the time. You know, as being a kid, well, we lost everything, and that's it, you know. But it was a sad time for us. And it really set my dad back, because it was during the Depression, and eventually he lost the farm to boot. That's why in school, I actually did not, and not everybody knows this. This is something for you. Actually, I never finished school, high school. I got to the, within about 3 months, I guess. And then I went to work to help my folks. I left out of school because they were having a real hard time.
Well, that must have been hard for you. And this is that Depression era. And maybe we should spend some time on that, because most of the people alive today did not live through the Great Depression. And we think it's a hardship when our cell phone runs out of battery or our credit card gets lost. You know, what was the worst of it that you experienced? What were the things that you look back on now and say, boy, that was really severe?
Well, it's just looking back is how bad it was for my mother and father to go through this. But the people out in the country at that time were great. They all got together. They even got a car for us, got clothes. They just pulled us through at that time, you know, the people out there in the country.
Your neighbors, other farmers around there?
Farmers and neighbors there.
Well, that's neat. That's encouraging for us to hear today that happened. And what about having enough to eat and having clothes to wear? I mean, during the Depression, did you ever notice that things were different or tougher?
You know what? We raised most everything. My mother always had a big garden. And we had chickens and turkeys and ducks and cows. So we just about raised everything we used, you know, for food. That's just about the way it was at that time. Everybody did the same thing, you know.
Is that your secret to being so strong and sharp at 100 years old, that you were drinking that cream off the top straight from the cow when it was still hot?
Yeah, the people worry about having too much butter and cream and sugar and all that. We never even thought about that. That's all we had was that old thick cream. I remember my mother used to scrape it off the kettle with a fork or knife. Man, we thought that was good. That was pretty good with our cereal.
Oh, yeah. Nice and rich.
And we made our own butter. So we used all the butter we wanted, you know. And nowadays, they don't want you to have all that fat and all that. Well, we never even thought about it.
And you're 100 years old. You look like you're in better shape than I am, so I'm not going to shake a stick at it. Did you guys have refrigeration or electricity, indoor plumbing, all those things?
Well, we did have electricity, and I think that was probably what caused the house to burn down. You know, the wiring wasn't too good in those days. And I think that's what caused the house to burn down. But yeah, we had electricity.
And you mentioned having to quit school to go to work to help support the family, yes, pay the bills. I'm guessing that was hard because you probably played a few sports at what's now Bakersfield High School, home of the Drillers.
Well, I had to ride the bus. We're about 16 miles away from town, and so we rode buses. So I didn't get to play football, which I really love football and baseball. But I did do track because we could do that during the school hours, you know. But all the other sports were after school, and I had to ride the bus. So I never got to play baseball or anything in high school. And I wished I had, but I didn't.
So how'd you figure out how good you were in baseball? And which position did you play?
We just played all over the country, you know, out there in the country. And we had country teams. I guess I started so young that I got pretty good. Then I had a brother that was just a little older than I was. And we would practice against the old barn. We would get about, 15, 16 yards away from each other and throw that ball as hard as we could. And it bounced against the barn, so we didn't have to go pick it up very far. And anyway, that's the way we learned to really bat. We got pretty good at batting because we got a whole hard sponge ball or a tennis ball and just stood pretty close to each other and threw it hard as we could. And we got pretty good at hitting. In fact, I was the leading hitter in that tournament when we played in the World Softball Tournament. I had 438 was what I batted in the tournament.
And what position did you play?
I played in the outfield, all three places. But in 1950, when I was playing with the Hulk Packers, our first baseman got hurt. So they put me over there on first base, and I wasn't the first baseman, but they put me there. That's where I played so good.
It's hard for us younger folks to understand this, but you guys didn't have Major League Baseball on the West Coast back then. So did you have any baseball heroes or someone you read about or heard about that you kind of looked up to or admired?
Always looked up to Joe DiMaggio. He was playing with the San Francisco Seals, and then, of course, he went up to the Major Leagues. Of course, Bob Feller, I looked up to him quite a bit. Of course, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, all those old-timers, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why I was a Yankee fan, on account of Joe DiMaggio and Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. I looked up to them so much.
Well, and you might have played against Joe DiMaggio in the Pacific Coast League when he was with the Seals because you had a tryout with the Hollywood Stars. How did that come about?
Well, there was three of us kids here. We got a chance to go down there to Hollywood and try out. And so they had us play and then to find out our different talents. And I was the only one of the three of us that made the team. And I was in center field. I did real good, but two other kids, we didn't have any money. And they wanted to come home. And like a crazy fool, I come home with them. And that ended my career trying it out for baseball.
Have you ever wondered about that? What would have happened?
Yeah, other people have too, and they wondered, well, what would have happened if you'd have stayed down there with them? But it didn't work out that way. We didn't think, you know, at that time, you don't think when you're a young kid, you know. We were probably 17, 18 years old. So it just didn't turn out right.
Yeah, because who knows? I mean, this was before World War II. Yeah. You might have been discovered. You might have been in the big leagues a few years from then.
Everybody thought so. Everybody around here after we played later on in the 40s around here. And I've had a lot of people tell me I was the best player they'd ever seen here in Bakersfield. So I don't know. We had a lot of good players here. You know, it just didn't turn out right for me.
You already told me you're a good hitter. I'm guessing you must have been pretty fast, too.
Yeah, I could run. That's what I did in track. I ran the 100, the 220. So I could run, yes.
This area, this whole San Joaquin Valley, has a pretty rich legacy when it comes to track and field stars. There's some Olympic gold medalists that have come from around here, and the greatest pole vaulter ever, Dutch Warmerdam. Did you ever run into people that went on to do great things in track?
Not really, because stayed pretty close to home here. I got married in 41, so I just stayed pretty close to home and didn't really get out.
Well, maybe that's why you turned down the Hollywood Stars, because you had to come back here and meet someone who was going to be the star of your life for 76 years. How did you meet Mary Catherine?
It was funny. We had an old skating rink, a roller skating rink, and I couldn't skate, but we come in, the kids, there was three of us boys come in from out the country in Weed Patch.
What do you mean you couldn't skate? You just told me you're the best baseball player Kern County's ever had. You couldn't skate.
Anyway, we come in to go to that roller rink. So I was trying to get around that rink, and I fell down. And this girl come by, and she picked up my hand and helped me get up. That was my wife later on. That's how I met my wife, was at the roller rink when she picked me up. And she picked me up forever after that.
Well, I guess it's a real good thing you couldn't skate then.
Yeah, it sure was. So she was still in high school at the time. I was just out. Anyway, we started going together, and we went together 4 years before we were married. So we got married in 1941.
And, of course, everyone knows that World War II started for America in 1941, but it was going earlier than that in Europe. And I'm thinking about what you shared about your father coming here from England. Did you guys have relatives that were still in England? Did you hear about the war before it came to America?
Not really, because we didn't have any communication over there with them too much. But my dad come over here when he was 16 years old. He come over on a cattle ship, and he worked his way. And he evidently ended up in Iowa on a dairy farm. He knew the dairy business pretty good. And they eventually ended up in, just above Redlands there in this San Mateo Canyon. And he got a dairy ranch up there. That's where all my older brothers and sisters were raised in there. And then they moved to Porterville from there.
Well, I guess that makes you a real minority in Bakersfield, right? Because I think everyone that's 80 or older in Bakersfield came from Oklahoma. That's what I heard.
Well, you're right, because we were out there in the Wheat Patch area, and that's where they all come to. Jack Rabbit Camp, we call them Jack Rabbit Camp. Anyway, they come out there on our farm, on the ditch banks. We got water from the canals at that time, so we had big ditches. These people come out here, and under the cottonwood trees, they pitched a tent or something, and they were everywhere out there. And so we were surrounded by the Okies. We called them Okies all the time.
Yeah.
Okies and Arkies.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they had to flee that Dust Bowl and go somewhere, and they came here, and yeah. A lot of them have stuck, and you've stuck around here. And I'm curious, so you talk about meeting Mary Catherine and marrying her in 1941. Did it ever occur to you that war might be imminent for the U.S., that this might be something that could happen?
Yes, it was, because, you had kind of heard a little bit in the news, and everything going on over in Europe at the time. We were pretty sure that we were going to, of course, they had the draft on at that time. So we pretty well knew that we were going to be drafted sooner or later. But they did take me because I was working in the oil fields at the time, and they need oil. So the oil workers got delayed, and I was married, and that helped. But they finally caught me.
And we'll hear more about that when we come back. 100-year-old Leonard Francis is our guest today. I think you're going to get a kick out of the nickname his fellow sailors gave him in boot camp. We're going to hear what it was like to ride out a typhoon in the Pacific and the unique way the men of his destroyer celebrated news of the Japanese surrender. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with a spirited centenarian. Leonard Francis turned 100 years old on the day after Christmas in Bakersfield, California. He grew up just outside of Bakersfield in a place called Weed Patch and served on the destroyer USS Ludlow during World War II. But you know what? I haven't asked him yet about the start of World War II for the U.S. I'm sure you remember it. How did you experience December 7th, 1941?
Out there in the farm, we all got together. We had to play football every Sunday. And we were out playing football, and that's when we heard that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And we were really out there playing football.
Did you have a little break, or did you just keep right on playing football?
Well, we finished playing football because it always ended up in a fight anyway, you know. The sandlot football. Always ended up in a fight. We didn't think too much of it at the time, how bad this was going to affect us and everything. But I think about every one of those kids were drafted.
So you get married in February. The war starts in December. You've got a deferment because you're working in the oil business. You're married. And then you became a father. Did that change how you felt about the prospect of being drafted now that you've got a wife and a kid and eventually two sons before they drafted you?
Yes, I'll say. It did worry me because I sure didn't want to leave the wife with the two kids, but it come about.
How did she feel about that?
Well, I'm sure she never griped a bit about it. She just knew that probably she was going to have to go to work and just to make the best she could of it. I'll never forget when I was in boot camp in San Diego, how she would pile the kids in. I had a 41 DeSoto, and she would put those two kids in that DeSoto and drive all the way down to San Diego on the weekend to see me.
I bet the other sailors were jealous of that.
Yeah, it was pretty tough on her. I didn't realize at the time how tough it was for a lot tougher for her than was for me. She went to work. She went back to living with her mother and father. So she made up okay. She got through that part of the war.
Well, I'm sure she was hoping and praying, probably saying a lot of prayers that you were going to come back home. And I'm glad that you're sharing this because, you know, we hear a lot of stories. And most of the guys who are still alive today from World War II, they weren't married yet when they went off to the service. They were 17, 18, 19 years old, and they would have never met their spouse if they didn't make it home. But I'm glad that you're sharing this because it did interrupt lives all over this country. And here you got to leave a wife and two boys behind as you sail off to war. What did the Navy have you doing? What was your job on that destroyer, the Ludlow?
I was a gunner's mate. We took care of the 5-inch guns on the rear of the ship. There was 2 5-inch guns on the rear and 2 in the front. That was my job, to take care of that 5-inch gun on the back.
And before you got drafted and went on to serve in the Navy, I'm sure you knew a lot of other guys from the area who were already in the war. Did you get news from the war? Did you have a sense for how it was going or what kind of dangers you might be up against?
No, not really. I just didn't give a thought. I don't know why, but never thought about what could happen. We just took life as it come, you know, and that's just what happened. We had to go and then never give it too much of a thought. When I was in boot camp, like you say, I was kind of older. I think I was about 26 years old, and all the other kids in boot camp were from Texas, and they were 17 and 18-year-old kids. Of course, they all call me Grandpa. I was Grandpa in the Navy. But anyway, when we were down in boot camp, there was 179 in our company, and there was a lot of companies down there. They were all about the same, and they had a softball tournaments every day. I mean, we played softball every day, and our company never lost a game all the time I was there. We set a new record for all the time we were there. We never lost a game. So we were kind of having fun there, but it wasn't too much fun when we left. I was sent out to Honolulu, and I caught the ship in Honolulu. That's how come I ended up on the Ludlow. It come from the Atlantic. It had been serving over there, and it come over here this one. They were just about through over there at that time. So it was a great ship. Now I look back, I enjoyed it was being on that submarine. I called it a submarine because half the time we were in underwater.
You were below deck a lot?
Yeah, I'll say.
Well, and something else strikes me, too. Just to get to Hawaii to catch that ship, that's probably the first time that you've ever been on a ship on the ocean coming from Weed Patch.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I didn't know how I would make out, you know, whether I'd get seasick or not. I don't remember getting seasick going over there, but later on the Ludlow, we had some pretty rough weather, and we had gotten a lot of those typhoons over there, and we all got sick. Yeah, it was pretty rough. Those destroyers, they were up and down, you know. Weren't like a battleship or a carrier.
I had one destroyer sailor tell me one time that being on a destroyer in a typhoon made you feel like you were a flea on an elephant.
That's right, too. Yeah. Well, we just go up and bounce down and up and down. When those typhoons went out, we had to take everything below deck. Everything got to secure it and put it down below deck. And I thought, well, why don't we stay here in the harbor? Why are we going out in the ocean for the typhoon? And they said, well, because if you're in the harbor, you bounce against other ships and everything, they wreck, you know, you wreck them. And so they went out. So that's how we go out there and just wait it out.
And what does that feel like? Where would you be when the ship is taking all these waves and trying to stay afloat during a typhoon?
Well, we had to stay below because there's no, you look at that ship, you know, you're not off the water very much on the rear. So we all went below in our bunks and stayed there. And that was another thing. We would miss meals because you had to go atop deck to get to the front end where where they served the meals was in the front. And we were in the back, our porters, and doggone, we couldn't get to, we had a heck of a time to get up there. You couldn't get up there because there was no passageways from the rear to the front. So we missed a few meals.
Well, with the way the seas were turning, you might not have kept the meals down anyway.
Yeah, we didn't want any anyway. You couldn't keep up with your dish.
Was that scary? To be down below and you can't see anything, but you just feel this constant roller coaster?
Well, yeah, I thought, man, this thing is not going to hold up because we go up and down. When you come down, it was just a big boom, big bounce. And I thought, man, this thing's not going to hold up, you know, pounding like that. But it did.
And did you only have one typhoon like that, or are we talking two, three, four?
Well, you know, only that one, really, was the only one we had to go out in, except when the war was over, we went up to Alaska, and we were coming in there at Thanksgiving time, and we were going to get to go ashore for Thanksgiving in Alaska on that too. So the orders come that they needed a ship to go to Siberian waters for weather ship to relieve another ship, and wouldn't you know, it was our ship picked. So they sent us back out there. We was in that Siberian waters, and it was just rough all the time. There was no let up there. So we stayed out there a couple more weeks doing weather work. I don't know what we were doing. I thought it was crazy. Here we out there. So we never even got to go ashore for Thanksgiving.
Did you make it home by Christmas?
Yes, I think we did. We took some soldiers off of Attu Island and brought them to San Francisco. There was about 25 soldiers there that was stuck, and I think we picked them up and brought them into San Francisco.
And I don't want to miss anything that we sailed right past on the Ludlow there, but it is a destroyer, and you jokingly said submarine, but that would be the only probably more dangerous kind of boat to be on. The submarines were boats, and they suffered more losses, casualties per number of sailors than anybody else. But a destroyer wasn't necessarily a safe place. You're out there to protect the bigger ships. How'd you feel about that?
Well, you know, we didn't think anything about it. We were mostly watching for submarines and the floating bombs. You know, we just thought that was our duty. We never gave it much thought. That's what we're supposed to do. We were together. There were six in the group. And we were protecting the, you know, the other, escorting the other vessels, the battleships and the cruisers and carriers. We had no trouble, you know. It just, at the end of the war, The only thing we did see some those kamikaze planes come across. But, of course, they weren't after us. They were after those carriers and battleships. So we would shoot, but I don't think we hit anything.
Yeah, well, tell me that. When General Quarters sounded on the Ludlow, what did you have to do?
Well, we go to man our guns. Of course, those 5-inch guns weren't too good for that. They shot off other machine guns and stuff at that, like that time on the ship. You know, you couldn't move the barrel of that gun on the 5-inch. We just used that mostly for shooting on the islands. We would stand off maybe 4 or 5 miles from the islands and shoot. And when the troops were landing, you know, help them in order to land. But that was getting at the end of the war, and it wasn't really that bad. The Japanese were pretty well licked by that time, except the submarines were still out there, and they wanted us to protect, you know, for those. But we never did. I mean, I think this ship actually sucked a German submarine over before it come over here, Pacific. It had a pretty good record, but we never did sink anything.
Nothing sank you, more importantly. And you mentioned these 5-inch guns, and a lot of people listening probably don't have a concept, and 5 inches doesn't sound very big to them. But this is a big, loud gun. How many guys does it take to operate one of those?
Well, I think it was actually, you know, you had to hand load it. So everything come up from below. We had to pass them up and put them. So there was about 3 guys, you know, putting them in the breech and then handling, you know. It took quite a few guys to pass the ammunition up.
So that was your job, loading?
Yes, load the shells in the chambers there, the barrel.
And what does that sound like when that puppy goes off?
Oh, well, you notice I got ear laid. We would put cotton in ours. We didn't have earplugs. We put cotton in our ears, and it was pretty loud. That thing was pretty loud. And that barrel would get so hot, you could not touch it after you would fire 2 or 3 shells through there. That barrel got hot. It was quite an experience, something I never thought I'd go through, an old foreign kid out in the country.
Well, and I know you can laugh about parts of it now, but the reality is, even though this was later in the war, you're out there at sea, a submarine can sink you, a mine can take you out, one of those Japanese planes could bomb you or crash into you. Your life was in danger. Did you ever find yourself on that ship thinking, you know, I may never see Mary Catherine again. I may never get to see my boys grow up.
Well, you know, at the time you didn't, but later on you got to thinking, oh, golly, you could have been. I don't know. At the time you just didn't think about that. I don't know. Your mind is just blank on thinking you could get hurt. I don't know why, but never did think we would, and we could have, but luckily we didn't. One of the destroyers had a kamikaze hit his radar antenna, and of course he tumbled in, and we seen him. They were off for quite a ways away, but we could see the smoke and everything come up out of the water, but that was about as close as anything come to us. I don't know if we could hit them if they'd come.
And that whole time you were out there at sea during the war and even after the war, because you were out there for, you know, quite a while after the war, did you hear from your wife and sons?
Oh, yes. Quite often we got letters. My wife wrote quite a bit. I would try to write to her, too, and let her know what was going on, because I know she was worried. But we just wrote the letters, and then when we come into a port or somewhere, we get mail call. We sure look forward to that. You know, it was one thing we looked forward was mail call, and I always had 3 or 4 letters waiting for me.
Do you remember finding out that Japan had surrendered, that hostilities had ceased?
Oh, yeah. We were out at sea at the time. And when they announced that they set off the bomb, boy, we were so happy. That ship just went crazy, you know, because we knew that was going to end the war. And when we got word that the war was over, they surrendered. They stopped the ship. Now, you won't believe this, but they stopped the ship out there in the middle of the ocean, and we all got naked and jumped on the ocean. We took our clothes off. And everybody jumped in the ocean, and we swam out. They put a boat out there with guns in case sharks or anything were out there, and they made a little row out there, and they back and forth, and we were swimming out there in the middle of that ocean. Can you believe that? Naked. Uh-huh. Everybody was naked. They would get as high as they could get on that ship and jump off of it.
Surprised nobody got hurt.
Yeah, nobody. We didn't lose anybody out there. That was quite an experience, too. Yeah, when we heard the war was, they surrendered. That's when the captain stopped your ship, and they let us go swimming in the middle of the ocean.
It kind of sounds like that might have been the most memorable swim of your life.
It really was. Now I think about it, that ocean's pretty deep out there to be swimming in it.
We have heard a lot of stories on Hometown Heroes over the years, but I don't think we've heard a VJ Day story quite like that one. And there are more stories to come from 100-year-old Leonard Francis. He may never have suited up with Joe DiMaggio, but he would be no stranger to world championships after the war. And we'll also hear what going with other veterans on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. meant to him. Find photos of Mr. Francis at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling, but more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Navy veteran Leonard Francis of Bakersfield, California. We've heard a few highlights from his colorful century of life, how he tried out for the Hollywood Stars of the pre-war Pacific Coast League and was actually offered a spot in professional baseball, but turned it down because the friends he rode down there with did not make the squad. We heard how he met his wife, Mary Catherine, because he couldn't skate, and she's the one who helped him up after he fell down at the roller rink. We heard how he had to leave Mary Catherine and their two young sons behind when he sailed off to war. Mrs. Francis passed away last year, and last week Leonard marked what would have been their 77th anniversary by paying a visit to her grave. He, of course, looks forward to their eternal reunion, but we need to get the story of their reunion after his Navy service in World War II on the destroyer USS Ludlow.
Oh, yes, that was great. You know, they took those ships, all six of those destroyers, and we went back to Charleston, South Carolina. We went through the canal, and that's where they were going to decommission them. And so we were back there for a little while, and then whenever we got discharged, there was several of us got discharged same time back there in North Carolina. We come by train to Long Beach, and we were discharged in Terminal Island. And that was one of the happiest days of my life because my wife was waiting there with the boys.
Did they remember who you were, the boys?
Yeah, they did. The little one, I don't think he knew too much, but they knew who I was, all right.
You know, most of us haven't lived through something like this, so I know I asked some questions that may seem kind of obvious or dumb to you, but when you go through something like that, when you're separated from your wife and kids and half a world away with your life in danger, and then it's all over and you come back, do you have a different perspective on life moving forward after that's all over?
I don't really think so. I just knew we had to go on, and that didn't really change much. It was just one of those things that had to be, and it was all over, and we were so happy that the war was over. Just life had to go on, that's all.
And I know back here in Kern County, you worked for Coca-Cola and as well as a beer distributor, delivering beverages around and all that. But you also traveled a lot playing softball. And as you mentioned before, this was a big deal. How competitive was fast-pitch softball for men in the 40s and 50s?
Well, it was really big. We would have out at our fairgrounds, we played out here at the fairgrounds, they called it. We would get 3,000, 4,000 people there. And that was quite a few people in those days because, you know, really, they didn't have anything else to do. You know, you didn't have television and you didn't have much of anything. We didn't have any professional sports or anything. So they just went to softball. So we all just played softball. And Taft in 48, they wanted to get a team over in Taft. And that's a little town about 35, 40 miles west of Bakersfield. So they gathered all the best softball players they could get, and we made a team over in Taft, and that was in 48. And we got pretty good. We could beat everybody around because we had a very good pitcher named Les Haney. There was a traveling team of colored fellows. They was named Sioux City Ghosts, and they traveled all around the United States playing teams, and they come out here and played us, and nobody could beat them. But we come out here and played us, and we beat them. So they thought, well, these guys are pretty good. We ought to send them to the national tournament. And so we did. We made up, and at that time, the national tournament was in Oklahoma City. So the Taft City, they called it the Taft Merchants, and they got up enough money to send us back to Oklahoma City with on a train. And by golly, we fooled around and won that tournament. We won the world championship in 48 with Taft.
And that wasn't your last championship for you.
That was really the first one. After that, we played, and then we played up north. They had what they called a valley league, you know, different little towns up the valley, Corcoran, Selma, and all those little towns around Fresno. So we played up there. I played with the Hope Packers. They picked me up, and that's when we played. We went back to Greeley and played, and we won the tournament back there in Greeley. So in all together, I played in six Worlds Championships, different World Championships. And we won four of them. And we played for teams from all over the United States and Canada and Australia. We had a pretty good team.
Well, and I know that they put your Hoke Packers team and that era of teams from that Hoke Packers squad in the Fresno Athletic Hall of Fame. Are you in any other halls of fame?
No, that's the only one.
Sounds like you ought to be in the International Softball Congress Hall of Fame back there, too. Maybe we need to let them know that you're still going at 100, and they'll think about it. With all those exploits and that success in softball, that was probably something that was hard to let go of when you had to do that.
Yeah, you know, I played a long time because I started out there at Weed Patch when I was about 11 years old. And I think when I quit playing, let's see, I was in 50, I think 56 was the last one I played. So I played a long time, and I really enjoyed it. Then I took up golf.
And I read something that made me do a double take. I've met a lot of guys who have shot their age before. I've met guys with as many as 13, 14 holes in one. But I read that you shot a 72 when you were 90 years old. Is that true?
Yes, it is. I did. I was playing pretty good.
Most of us will never do that.
But you know, I could never break 70. I never got into the 60s, and I always wanted to do that, and I never did. I think the first time I broke my age limit, I was traveling in Canada. We had a trailer, and the wife and I, we traveled all over, and we stopped in Calgary. And I went out to play golf in Calgary there, waited around in the clubhouse, and the pro said he would get me off with somebody. And so in about a half an hour or so, he told me, he says, I got a threesome here, and you can make a foursome with them. And I said, fine, that's good. And so we went out there. Two guys, they wanted to play one of their buddies and me. I didn't know how they played or what they did. So they wanted to have a little bet, and I said, okay, we will. And that's when I broke my age. I shot 70 up there, and those guys couldn't believe it. Those Canadians. Of course, we won their $2. And they couldn't believe it. And I was pretty lucky. That's when I first broke my age.
You probably lost count of how many times you did that.
You know, I have. I got so with it, every time I played, I broke an age. So every time I played, I don't know how many hundred times I played. The older I got, the easier it got.
And you kept playing until you were 97, huh?
Yes.
What do you think would happen if you went back out to the tee right now?
I'd fall down flat on my face when I swung that club.
But the ball would go straight as an arrow right down the fairway, right?
Yeah, you know, that was one the guys that always laughed. They said, you don't have to go look. Golf is not very good for you. All you do is go right down the middle. You don't see any of the course.
Well, and in those later years, as you're shooting your age, every time you take your clubs out to the course, something else came around. And here in your hometown, they started Honor Flight Kern County, and they started taking World War II veterans back to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. And you got to do that. And I see some pictures right over there. In fact, there's Kevin McCarthy, one of the most powerful guys in our government right there. And he's making you look like the hero in that photo to me. What was that experience like for you? What'd you get out of it?
Well, it was one of the greatest experiments I've had. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and they just couldn't have been better taking care of us. They were so good. I didn't realize that what a job they were doing, but all of those people that took us, they were, everything just worked just slick as a whistle. And it was a great experience. I'd never been back to Washington, D.C., and to get to see all those memorials and see everything. I went to Arlington Cemetery, and I was really impressed. And the changing of the guards amazed me about those service guys there that do that. It was just a great experience for me that I would have never been able to do unless it had been for that honor flight. And I certainly thank them.
Well, I know you get back together with those folks quite a bit when they have their breakfasts around here and all that. But I'm interested, when you were there, I know it's been a few years, but I'm sure you remember, when you're standing at that World War II memorial and you realize, you know, this is what I was involved with, and you see the different elements of it that point to the Atlantic and the Pacific and the different battles, and then that wall of all the gold stars, and it says this represents 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. What went through your mind while you were looking at all of that?
Well, it was pretty tough, you know, to see those, you know, and it brought back memories, you know, that you'd forgot about. And you walk around there and you see some of those islands and you knew you were there. It was just such a great experience to look at that and honor those fellows that didn't come back. And it was pretty sad to think. Pretty emotional, you know, to see what some of them did, you know. And they were such great heroes, the guys that never come back. They're the ones that you got to honor, you know. It was just a great experience for me for that honor flight to take us back there. We were accepted back there so well. When the plane landed in the airport and we went through the terminal, they had a line of people waiting for us to greet us. And I couldn't believe that. And I never had so many women kiss me in my life as I did there back in Washington, D.C., giving me a kiss. So I was real happy.
Uh-huh. And did you leave that lipstick on for when you came back and saw your wife, or did you wipe it all off?
No, I didn't tell my wife. I had so many kisses.
Well, it's a couple other things I want to ask you about the honor flight, but I'm just thinking about when you were there at that memorial. And you just said the guys who didn't come home are the guys that need to be honored. Did you have any friends or acquaintances that you lost during the war?
Yes, there was two. One of them was on a submarine. Another one, well, he wasn't lost, but he lost both arms. He was quite a guy. He lost both arms. It was blowed off. So those, you know, you kind of makes you wonder, and you're pretty close to those. And the kid on the submarine, of course, they never got him, you know, the submarine was sunk. His name was Hobbs. It's pretty sad whenever, you know, to think about those kids that didn't come home.
And you did. Your daughter wouldn't be here if you didn't. She would have never been born. You wouldn't have had all those years with your wife, 76 years of marriage with Mary Catherine. You got some advice for the rest of us? I don't know if any of us can live long enough to catch you, but 76 years is a long time. What was your guy's secret?
Well, I guess she was the secret. She just kept us together. I never seen such a woman that was so easygoing and so easy to get along with. I could just see her. Oh, I better not. Oh, boy. I don't know how to get over her.
I wish I would have had the privilege of meeting her.
Quite a woman. Anyway, I don't know. She just kept things together. She was such a great woman. And even before she passed away, she was still trying to help me. She was always saying, can I get you anything? And when she couldn't hardly move, and here she still wanted to help me.
Sounds like she set the bar pretty high.
She really did. I don't know how long it'll take me to get over. I go up to the cemetery. She's buried up there in the Veterans Memorial Cemetery in Arvin. She passed away on the 14th of May, so we go up there every 14th of the month, put flowers on her grave. And now when I pass away, I think they put me right on top of her, so that'd be nice. We'll be back together again.
Well, I can hear the admiration and the love in your voice as you talk about her, and I know there's a lot of people that feel that way about you. But what are you most proud of? You made it to 100. Most people never do that. All these things that you've done or experienced, what would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I really don't know. I never gave a thought about being proud of anything. I'm proud of my family. I couldn't have better kids, you know, than they are. They gave me a nice 100th birthday party. I just couldn't ask for anything better than having the family that I have. I got a great daughter and another son, and a daughter, she's so wonderful for me. I wish I had more girls. I don't tell the boys that, but I wish I had more girls.
Of course, he doesn't mean that as a slight to his two sons, but that's going to give the family something to talk about as they prepare for his 101st birthday come December. I think you probably heard his centenarian smile through the radio today, but you can see it for yourself at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also find a little information about his softball exploits and even a link to more about the Sioux City Ghosts, that famous barnstorming team of African Americans who sometimes drew 25,000 to 30,000 fans to their exhibitions. You remember Leonard saying that his team from Taft beat the Ghosts back in 1948. We're just about out of time on Hometown Heroes for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.